Welcome to False Flag Weekly News, the weekly news show that destroys mainstream media fake news, Trump fake news. If it's fake news, we'll take it on. I'm Kevin Durrett with Professor Anthony Hall from the University of Lethbridge, coming at us from an undisclosed location on the southeast coast of Ireland. That's going to be another good show here. And to keep these good shows going, please do support False Flag Weekly News at the fundraiser page. You can find it. There's a link over here somewhere. And there it is. So moving on. Fake news. It's the big news these days, as it always is. And our first story is essentially tribute to our effectiveness here at False Flag Weekly News. Tony, majorities across the political spectrum agree with Donald Trump on one thing at least, even though he has very low popularity ratings, and that is that the mainstream publishes fake news. Do you think people are catching on?
Well, they're catching on, but Donald Trump, in a sense, is a generator of conspiracy theories. His prelude, his warm-up act, Alex Jones, showed the way and enabled Trump to present himself as a kind of outsider, flailing against the dastardly establishment, this billionaire using conspiracy theories. And of course, it raises the issue, is everything a conspiracy? Do you just say everything is a conspiracy? And you have addressed that in your debate with Betzer, I believe.
Dr. Yeah, Betzer. We'll be talking about that, but we're gonna do the next story is a different fake news related story, and that is the Muslim rape armies invading Europe. One of these stories that was everywhere throughout the fake alternative media, that is the right-wing media, was that there was supposedly an incident in which 51 evil Muslim Arab immigrants were beat up for groping women in a bar in Murmansk, Russia, which is right about on the Arctic Circle. And it's the most ridiculous story. Jonathan Rivusky totally takes it down in this fantastic article, which I just put up at Veterans Today. So when you hear rumors of evil dark-skinned savages mistreating white women, remember that's what drove the lynchings of hundreds and hundreds of African-Americans in the United States. And let's hope that no such thing happens over in Europe.
And it's the kind of thing that got the U.S. president, the current U.S. president, in power. And we'll definitely be taking time to look at this phenomena of Islamophobia and the way it unites different political constituencies when we consider Spencer Sunshine's analysis of this whole phenomena.
So when you see evil Muslim stories, you can be 99% sure that it's fake news. But those Trump-supported fake news pro-Islamophobia stories are not the only kind of fake news over on the other side of the mainstream political spectrum. We have the New York Times. Look at this, Tony. This is today's New York Times headline. I mean, this is my screenshot of their headline. Look at that. Independent journalism more essential than ever, they say. And then look at this Israeli puff piece right there on their front page. Israel seeks stability and goodwill in aid to Syrians on the border by somebody named Kirshner. Tony, you can't make this stuff up.
Well, I must say the order of the stories is a bit of a surprise to me, but what do you mean Israel is not seeking stability and goodwill with Syrians on the border? What if they are? And you're just making it up. Fake news that they're not. Let's go into it. Maybe they are. Maybe they've changed their ways. Maybe they had some kind of catharsis.
Tony, stop. Stop. You're killing me. I'm going to die laughing, and you'll have to do the rest of the show alone. Okay. Where were we here? Okay. Let's move on to the real news. That's enough on fake news. How about the 9/11 weekly news, Tony? Lots of 9/11 stories. 9/11 is the gift that keeps on giving to all the bad guys throughout the world and also to those of us trying to expose the truth about it. So how about this one? This was the story that we missed last week. We didn't miss it, Tony. This is BS. This is a nonsense fake news story, a nonsense story about an alleged confession to the demolition of Building 7. This is the same story that the same disinformation guy wrote about the murder of Princess Diana just a month or two ago. So somebody is spewing out garbage trying to hook people in the alternative infosphere who maybe are not quite skeptical enough.
Maybe Jay Greenberg, who wrote this piece, it doesn't say where it appeared. Is it on your news?
No. This originally appeared at the site that is here in the screenshot, and what is that site called? It's got a very strange name. It's not popping to mind right now. Anyway, it showed up there, but then it made its way throughout a bogus web. Neon Nettle.
Yeah, and of course, this would classically fulfill Cass Sunstein's request, his operation to try to bring in cognitive infiltration to kind of make these stories, these narratives of what happened on 9/11, false flag terrorism, the things that actually are true and are being covered up, to see that there's a range of disinformation sprinkled in among these stories to confuse everybody and to make it all seem like a hopeless mess of conflicting information.
That's right. And that's what Cash Dunstein means by beneficial cognitive diversity. He wants to disable the purveyors of conspiracy theories. That means us. And one of the ways he wants the government to do that is by spreading what he calls beneficial cognitive diversity. So there's a lot of cognitive diversity when some people actually believe these blatantly bogus made-up stories. And moving on to the next slide, my good friend Jim Fetzer, I still consider him a friend. Here he is with me and David Ray Griffin. But unlike David Ray Griffin, who errs, if anything, on the side of too much caution and really being very careful in thinking things through and documenting all of his sources and making sure he has good sources, Jim Fetzer, who's quite a genius in certain respects, he's a good talker. We had him here on False Flag Weekly News for years. But he loves to lap up these fake stories. Not all the time, but he's, he bit on this one too, this WTC7 story. So I had a little debate with Jim on my radio show last Friday night about this, and it was great. I mean, actually, he acquitted himself really well, considering the circumstances. So anyway, Tony, I'm glad that that frankly, as much as I love Jim Fetzer, he's a fun guy. He's not a bad guy, like some people are saying in the Veterans Today comment section. But he's a little too reckless with his sources, frankly, in my opinion.
Well, and then you have David Ray Griffin, Professor Griffin, who I visited in his home in Santa Barbara, California, along with Jeremy Roth-Kuschel. And my goodness, 10 books the man has written. Really, he should get some kind of major prize, Nobel Prize, Pulitzer Prize. He's cautious, but he definitely, after he did his 10 books on 9/11, there is no way any intelligent person who is well-informed on sources can say that the official narrative is backed up by the evidence. It's quite the contrary. And David Ray Griffin has created a monument, a scholarly monument in 9/11 studies.
Absolutely. So, and Jim Fetzer is a force to be reckoned with too. A little out of control sometimes, but he's certainly worth listening to skeptically. Next slide. David Noble is another Trump guy like Jim Fetzer, although Jim, I think, has jumped off the bandwagon. David Noble's still working on Trump. David is an architect and attorney out of Southern California. He campaigned for Trump. He's with lawyers, volunteer lawyers for Trump. And he's written a series of, I think, like 28 letters explaining 9/11 to Donald Trump and focusing on the fact that Israel did it. And he says that people close to Trump have indeed read the letters and are responding in, well, let's just say, not a particularly negative manner. Tony, that's good news, I guess.
Yeah, and it's interesting that architects and engineers is always a faction of people in 9/11 truth movement who say, don't raise the Israel question. It just spurns people. It just turns people away. But the question comes up and David Noble raises it, well, people want to know who did it and why did they do it? Was it done to advance the agenda, the current agenda of war, or was it psycho-Islamic jihadists trying to create a global caliphate through this surprise attack? Which seems like the more logical.
Great idea. yeah, blow up a couple of buildings. That'll definitely get you a global caliphate. Well, one of the points David Noble raised in this interview, as well as in his letters to Donald Trump, is that this Robert Mueller investigation of Trump could easily be torpedoed if Trump would just convene a special investigation of 9/11, an honest one. And, Mueller was appointed exactly 1 week before 9/11 as FBI director to preside over the 9/11 operation and its cover-up. So David Noble wants Donald Trump to investigate 9/11 and stop Mueller in his tracks. That sounded like a good idea to me. And that's our next slide, by the way, is this Trump pushback against Mueller from the New York Times.
Yes, well, the story of 9/11, let's be clear that Donald Trump's core constituency, many of them are 9/11 truthers, brought into the fold primarily by Alex Jones. And this combining of 9/11 as an inside job with Islamophobia, which Jim Fetzer does, Alex Jones does, which Trump, the U.S. president, does, which Bannon does. I mean, it really is strange that you have people who know about 9/11, know that the narrative isn't true, yet nevertheless falling into this trap of Islamophobia, which was the reason for 9/11, to create this toxic imagery of Muslim people around the world, the Ummah.
Indeed. And speaking of which, our next slide brings us more 9/11 news. That is the Hawaii soldier busted for supposedly swearing allegiance to ISIS. And of course, ISIS was like, a couple of FBI agents. This guy thought 9/11 was a false flag, and he even questioned the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Wow, what a dangerous conspiracy theorist. No wonder he swore allegiance to ISIS. Tony, these stories, you can't make this stuff up.
And he didn't swear allegiance to the moon landing.
And, no, he didn't.
The fact that we're supposed to salute the United States and say in the days when you couldn't get the computer power in these massive rooms of cabinets, computer cabinets, you couldn't get the computer power of a single iPhone into all of those computers, but with that diffuse computing power, they somehow did it, somehow got on the moon.
Yeah, this whole notion that 9/11 truthers would support ISIS or terrorism, it's ludicrous. Muslims, and the vast majority of Muslims, know 9/11 was an inside job or a false flag, 80% globally and close to two-thirds in the U.S., such people, obviously, such as myself, are unlikely to think it's going to be beneficial to the project of pushing forward the Islamic awakening to make Islam look stupid and evil by running around massacring innocent people. It's insane. So anytime you see a news story that some 9/11 truther is supposedly swearing allegiance to ISIS, you have to know that this is being scripted somewhere. This is not reality.
Kevin, your voice is very important in terms of Islamic self-defense in an era when ideas and narratives are being turned to toxify minds against Muslim people. There has to be a voice of self-defense, and you lead the way in that regard.
Well, thanks, Tony. Yeah, we're working on a project to build a Muslim push radio network that would also be pushing the political views that we Muslims tend to share on these matters. More on that as it develops. But in the next slide, Tony, here's another 9/11 story. We had a flurry of 9/11 related stories this week. They're bringing in the 9/11 sifters and bucketers to look for human remains in what's left of the Grenfell Tower, which of course didn't come down. And the interesting thing about this story to me is that those 1,000 experts in sifting through rubble, or what little was left of the Twin Towers, they were the world's greatest experts in finding as much as a sliver of a fingernail or a bone fragment or anything, a little morsel of flesh, anything that could be DNA identified. So they did this for a decade. And guess what? In our next slide, we see that there are more than 1,000 people who were vaporized in the Twin Towers. Not even so much as a tiny bone fragment was found of this more than 1,100 people. So I bet they find just about remains of everybody that died in the Grenfell Tower, because if a tower burns or collapses, the full bodies of everybody are going to be left. They may be burned, they may be squashed, but the whole body will be there. In New York, more than 1,000 people were vaporized. Tony, to me, this is pretty much absolute proof of not only a demolition, but of the use of a nuclear weapon or miniature nuclear weapons or other such items that would completely vaporize all human remains, not leaving so much as even a little piece of bone or flesh.
Well, this aspect of 9/11, the fact that the buildings didn't just fall down and collapse like melting steel and pancaking down into a great pile of refuse at the bottom, the buildings themselves, the towers themselves, were transformed into talcum powder and vaporized, and the human remains are vaporized, and the computers and such. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it takes a huge amount of energy. Where did the energy come to make this transformation of so much matter into vapor, into talcum powder-like material? And of course, we can debate the technology till the cows come home of how this might be done, technology that we know about, maybe technology that we don't know about. But the reality is there's a tremendous consensus that those towers didn't come down the way we were told by the 9/11 Commission, by NIST. That part of the story is completely discordant with the available evidence.
That's right. And you can see the interviews with the first responders saying things like, you know, there was not a single remain of a desk, of a chair. All we ever found of any of the 10,000 plus telephones was a tiny little sliver of a keypad. I mean, the whole thing was vaporized. And you know, Judy Wood, for whatever you think of her work, she may have it right in the sense that whatever they use some way of essentially vaporizing so much of the mass in those towers so that the mass wouldn't crash to Earth, bust the bathtub, which was holding back the East River from flooding the entire underground of New York, including the subways. That would have pretty much put New York out of commission for a long time. They didn't want anything that big. So when they demolished the towers, they found a way to make sure that that mass did not come crashing to Earth. And precisely how they did it, we'll probably have to wait for a real investigation to find out. But we sure know that we need an investigation. This was not a fire-induced collapse. You can't have more than 1,000 people vaporized by a fire-induced collapse.
And another aspect of it is, remember on 9/11 in the morning, we were speculating, 50,000 people, it's going to be a huge number of people. 3,000 people, losing 3,000 people is a great tragedy, but it's not that many people. And was it possible that part of the 9/11 prelude and deal was some effort to keep the casualties to a minimum? That might have been part of what was required by some of the parties to the deal.
Well, they modeled 9/11 on Pearl Harbor, and they probably tried to kill about the same number or a few more, and they did a pretty good job of that. Well, whoever they were, it wasn't the Saudis. Next slide is once more the Saudi 9/11 connection is appearing here. Theresa May's covering it up. Well, they're covering up the Saudi connection because the Saudis are puppets of the Zio American Empire.
Well, we were told it was a Saudi, it was Osama bin Laden, a member of a very powerful Saudi family. I mean, that was the story from the beginning, that it was a Saudi connection. When did that change? Interestingly, there's a group of survivor group, that's an interesting term to see come up in this context. And there was some kind of study, follow the money study of funding terror operations commissioned by David Cameron. And did this report, is it finished? Is it drafted? Where is it? Is it public? Jeremy Corbyn is trying to make it public. This survivor group is trying to make it public. But Theresa May is covering up and doesn't want it made public.
Of course not, because 9/11 is the gift that keeps on giving. And that includes here in the U.S. where the Defense Authorization Bill allows for unending wars against the entire world based on 9/11. And this week we had the Republican leaders trying to removing language that would have repealed this and forced them to take a second look at the authorization to invade and destroy the entire world in general, in the Middle East in particular, based on 9/11.
And of course, Peter Dale Scott, he talks about the Continuity of Government Act that came in and sort of replaced constitutional governance as we've known it with a kind of secret cabal that run things from undisclosed locations. Gee, that doesn't look like anything like the government that we have, this accountable government that we have. What's going on there?
And they've been running this emergency, this state of emergency, this police state, this totally non-democracy, non-republic since 9/11, based on scapegoating and the main scapegoats have been the Muslims. Islamophobia is the rule of the day, replacing the Cold War enemy of communism. And so let's move on to the Islamophobia Weekly News category. We had Spencer Sunshine in the news, our old friend Tony, the guy who got us barred from the left forum this year, so we had to go out and do a left out forum ourselves. And here he is pretending to be fighting Islamophobia, and he does everything he can to obscure the fact that the Zionists, and that's you, Spencer, created Islamophobia in the first place and are doing everything to maintain it. And to stop it, we have to stop it, end Zionist control of the United States and reveal the fact that the Zionists did 9/11. Spencer is on the Zionist team. He doesn't want that to happen. He wants Islamophobia to continue. And so he writes an article here that is calculated to make sure that Islamophobia does continue.
Well, he refers to something called right-wing Zionists. So I assume that he perceives of himself as a left-wing Zionist.
Yes.
Because he's clearly a Zionist. He clearly puts Israel first, and that is obviously the central principle of his literature and his analysis. But it's interesting, his point that Islamophobia is unifying a whole group of strange bedfellows, different organizations. And there is truth in it. He lists, for instance, calls them Nazis, right-wing Zionists, LGBTQ activists. Isn't that interesting to see them in the list? And right-wing paramilitary, something called alt-light teens. Maybe he invented that. And racist skinheads. This is his picture of the Islamophobia A-team.
And these are the zombie armies that were created by the Zionists who had the ring. And so, you know, if you don't want the zombies to overrun your town, you better find the zombie master and put him out of commission, and that is Israel. So moving on, I pushed back against Spencer in a Press TV interview this week, pointing out that Islamophobia is the ongoing legacy of the 9/11 false flag. And then I had another debate on the same topic, or actually another Press TV appearance that was a debate with Frederick Peterson. And Frederick Peterson really lost it and just started yammering about Kevin's Comedy Hour. He accused me of being a comedian. Well, he must watch False Flag Weekly News, because every now and then I do say something mildly amusing, usually at the end of the show. So shout out to Frederick Peterson, who really doesn't like me very much.
Yeah, I wonder if he planned it, but he little by little developed this metaphor, Kevin's Comedy Hour, and then anything you would say, he would simply refer to your comic shtick, as it were. And, well, you do tend to be funny, and you do tend to satirize different events, and he kind of got that part maybe a bit right.
Well, you know, maybe I'm a comedian manqué. So, I don't know, maybe I could be the false flag version of Colbert someday when I grow up. But for the meantime, I'm going to keep on enjoying doing False Flag Weekly News as long as I can. Let's move on to the Terrorists Are Us category. That's right, ISIS is us, and the Iranians get it. They just sanctioned the U.S. for supporting terrorism, and they're absolutely right. I mean, it's the Iranians who are pursuing the real war on terror, Tony.
Yes, it's very interesting, these phrases that Bush used, you know, that we're going to go after the terrorists, and anybody who gives support to the terrorists and gives harbors the terrorists, etc. And the U.S. has been demonstrated to do all of these, to be backing ISIL, Daesh,
as we see in the next slide.
And working closely with Saudi Arabia, the sort of home of Wahhabism, which promotes this kind of takfiri approach to, basically builds up mercenary armies. And then these mercenary armies are depicted as terrorists who are made pawns in and give justification to various moves in the Middle East. So it is a fair response from Iran. And of course, they are responding to new sanctions, the Iranian government, that they are facing, because they are indeed studying the use and have in place anti-ballistic missiles, which are part of their self-defense. And if there is a force, if there is a country in the world that is actually facing a pretty dire threat, that would be the Islamic Republic of Iran.
And what are they talking about when they say the U.S. supports terrorism? Well, here we have the U.S. evacuating the ISIS commanders from Raqqa, And in the next slide, we see the helicopters flying over Raqqa, the U.S. helicopters. Seems like this happens every time, just like they evacuated the bin Laden folks in Afghanistan to make sure that they didn't get caught prematurely and put an end to the propaganda effort. ISIS, which is a complete false flag group destabilizing the region on behalf of the Israeli-American Empire, are basically run by us. And so when Mosul falls, when Raqqa falls, they're going to evacuate the commanders. And the U.S. mainstream media, Tony, is getting this so wrong. The next story, we had, in some ways, a very good, well-written piece from an embedded New York Times correspondent in Mosul. But the part that really pissed me off was when he starts insulting the Iraqis, because they all believe that there's a U.S. Zionist conspiracy to destroy Iraq. And of course, that's just paranoid conspiracy theories. But everybody in Iraq knows it. The only people who don't know it are the people that read and write for the New York Times.
One of the interesting things going on in Iraq is I think the United States government and the Iranian government are working kind of closely in the governance, such as it is, of Iraq these days. They have to be cooperating on some level. This idea of these terrorist groups as actually mercenary proxy armies, this is a simple idea. Jeremy Scahill, when he looked at Blackwater and, you know, looked at this new tendency of creating a mercenary army available for hire, he should have kept on with that theme, because I think what came to be in terms of ISIL and Daesh and such emerges from that Blackwater initiative to some extent. I remember people saying, it's going to be disastrous that the Sunni army of Saddam Hussein is just being left unemployed. But it turns out they're not really being left unemployed. They're working for US, Israel, NATO as a proxy army. And they know each other well. As they're sitting in the helicopter being flown out from Raqqa or Mosul to other locations to do other jobs, they will be very well acquainted with the higher echelons of the British, of the British and U.S. Military service.
So the portrait you get in the New York Times of what's really going on in the Middle East is it's fake news. You know, they bash Trump all the time for pushing fake news, but they're actually worse in many ways. And here we had a pretty good deconstruction of the New York Times coverage of Iraq, and in particular a specific article. This was originally published with an Alternet. So Tony, I thought this is pretty good media criticism.
Painting U.S. as noble democracy lover, Iran as sinister imperialist. Well, this is what we're seeing, imperialism, the Anglo-American Empire. Boy, here I am in Southern Ireland, and talk about being in a part of the world that has experienced imperialism. Cromwell was right here. I mean, this legacy of imperialism clearly goes through Britain, the British Empire, the American Empire, and now Israel sort of is assuming some kind of directing role in this imperial heritage, which goes way back, I would say, 1492, or, you know, we could go back to Alexander the Great or on and on. Imperialism, we have to understand what that is.
Absolutely. And it seems that the U.S. empire may be declining, at least in the Middle East, and the Israeli empire is rising. Sheikh Amran Hussein says that's due to 9/11, which was an Israeli coup d'etat that essentially knocked over the U.S. empire and propped up the new Zionist empire. In any case, Nafis Ahmed, another Muslim with a very good geopolitical kind of knowledge. In fact, Nafis, Sheikh Amran Hussein has this deep knowledge based on eschatology. Nafis Ahmed is one of the best empirical researchers we have. He contributed to Awakening David Ray Griffin, Gore Vidal, and many others on 9/11. He put out the seminal 9/11 truth book, The War on Truth, or actually The War on Freedom was the first version, and then The War on Truth followed that very early on after 9/11. And this was a great article about the Pentagon's own study declaring that the U.S. empire is collapsing, and here's how we're going to have to stave off the collapse.
Yeah, I recall reading his work in the early days of my 9/11 catharsis, and he really went into the Balkans. He understood how the Balkans, after the end of the Cold War, was a kind of warm-up zone for this larger scenarios of employing Islamic, instrumentalizing different facets of Islam and getting proxy armies and mercenaries and such out of that constituency, or people who have Muslim names or whatever, and deploying them in imperial ways. He writes that ultimately the Pentagon does this very interesting report, says, you know, we've got to take care of information better, we've got to spin, we've got to do propaganda better, we've got to have more weaponry and be more willing to use it. And his, Nafiz Ahmed's critique is that the document's utter inability, has an utter inability to recognize the role of the Pentagon in systematically pursuing a wide range of policies over decades, which have contributed directly to the very instability it now wants to defend against. And this is very interesting, that he talks about the Pentagon's inability to look in the mirror. So many of the problems identified in the report go back to the way the Pentagon has been treating the world as its kind of plaything, as a people to be molded into some idea of what U.S. interests and corporations want the world to be looking like.
Yeah, that was an interesting point, that they're hastening the collapse of their own empire that they say they're trying to prop up. And one of the ways they're trying to prop up the empire is through endless media propaganda. In our next slide, we had a pretty decent expose of this grotesque continuation of these lies about Putin and Russia that we're getting in the mainstream media and from places like the New York Times and the Washington Post that are supposedly at war with fake news and Donald Trump, who represents fake news for them. Well, they're just as bad as Trump. Here we have the all the journalists that Putin supposedly killed. Yeah, right. It turns out that this is a display of journalists who died on the job in Russia since the collapse of communism in 1989. And most of them died in the 1990s under Yeltsin. So this has nothing to do with Putin. And those who died since, they were mostly killed by drug dealers they were investigating, the Russian Jewish mafia and the oligarchs who run it. Those are the people that Putin's trying to get under control. And they're the ones killing the journalists for the most part. So this is a blatant, outrageous propaganda lie. And yet the mainstream media just keeps pushing this.
And this is the critique of a professor, Yasha Monk, a Harvard governance professor, a professor of governance. And so it exposes the misrepresentation. These pictures are presented as all the journalists who were killed by Putin. The author looking and critiquing Yasha Monk's work, he's basically saying this effort to smear Trump as collaborating with Putin, it's not really working, it's not really taking off. It's interesting, Brendan O'Connell, who was praising you a lot, Kevin, in your analysis of Netanyahu and Putin and their collaboration, you know, he was looking at how Israel takes all these military secrets from the United States, software, and then it immediately goes to Russia and to China. That this is that this idea that Putin is some kind of positive figure that can benefit the U.S. According to Brendan O'Connell, no way. China, Iran, Russia. You know, there's a and Israel are forming a kind of new core, it's not good news for the United States.
Well, I think the real situation is more that the unipolar moment is over. The U.S. is no longer running the world through its military bases and its cultural dominance. And 9/11 hastened that demise of the U.S. as the unipolar empire. And of course, 9/11 was done by the Zionists, and they're supporting their own interests. They want to create greater Israel and dominate the world as much as possible. And then these other countries have people who are pushing their own national interests as well. And Putin, whatever you want to say about him, I think he is sincerely pushing what he perceives as the Russian national interest, keeping the oligarchs somewhat under control. But yeah, working with Israel or working with whoever he can work with. I mean, that's what these guys do. They're realists. They're basically mafia dons. That's what you have to be to try to run a country. But I still think that we should be skeptical about the anti-Putin propaganda campaign, but we shouldn't be looking to Putin as a savior and be a savior for us or for anyone either. But in any case, Russia has put a stop to the U.S. March of regime change through Syria. As we see in the next slide, this week we learned that Trump has ended the so-called covert CIA program to help the anti-Assad rebels, that means ISIS. Well, maybe he ended the program, but I somehow don't think U.S. support for ISIS is going to stop because of this. It is sort of an admission of defeat, though, don't you think, Tony?
Yeah, I wouldn't take this too far. This is, as you say, a program. It's not a necessarily a whole change in direction. And, you know, George Bush and the neocons emerging from the project of New American Century, they didn't much like the CIA. And they tried to find ways around the CIA. And Bush's people don't very much like the CIA. So it's possible that, you know, this is a sort of a hit on the CIA. But the flow of money is going to go elsewhere, that Trump is not going to back off this regime change in Syria agenda that he's that Jared Kushner and others are forcing him into.
Well, another sign of the impending collapse of the U.S. empire, which is the theme of this section of False Flag Weekly News, is that Turkey is outing all the U.S. military locations in Syria. They just published a report of this secret information. So now anybody who wants to go after U.S. troops in Syria, which would be pretty much everybody in the region if they had a chance, at least knows where they are. Tony, Turkey no longer fears the U.S. since the U.S. tried to support Fethullah Gulen's attempted overthrow of Erdogan. It seems that Erdogan and the Turkish leadership has staked out a somewhat more independent course.
Erdogan, I think, is furious at the U.S. and Israel for backing the Kurdish forces. And so this is one of the marks against staying in that orientation. Erdogan seems to be pulling closer to the Soviet Union, not the Soviet Union, was the Soviet Union, now there's the Russian Federation. So that alignment is changing. I noticed that Germany is withdrawing. What's going to happen to Incirlik? There's this major U.S. base, a major U.S. base in Qatar, a major U.S. base in Turkey, Incirlik. Germany is pulling forces out of Incirlik. What's going to happen to Incirlik?
That's a good point, Tony. And Qatar, Turkey, and Iran are drawing closer together. And these are, with all their faults, these three countries have a certain right to call themselves the more progressive Islamic forces of the Middle East. Qatar may be the least of the three, but hey, they have to play with the deck, with the hand that they've been dealt as well. So these somewhat, relatively progressive and democratic forces in the Middle East, those three countries, are now confronting the U.S. Zionist empire and their peons, Saudi Arabia being the, one of them, and Israel, of course. I don't know if they're the peon or the tail that wags the dog, but the Saudis, the Israelis, the Gulf potentates, and al-Sisi in Egypt, the worst human rights violator in the Middle East who slaughters thousands of peaceful demonstrators, these are the dinosaurs. And the U.S. is on the side of the dinosaurs. I think that the U.S. empire is pretty much gone in the Middle East because Turkey and Iran, with the media empire in Qatar, are going to form an alliance that is going to bring down the House of Saud, which is going to collapse due to infighting among the family members of that incredibly corrupt family. And Israel's days are also numbered. It may last a little bit longer. So that's my prediction. What's yours?
Well, maybe folks in Israel would come to their senses and realize having better relations with your neighbors and friendly relations rather than trying to eliminate them and destabilize them would be a better course of action. I don't want to write anybody out of history, Kevin.
Okay, well, we don't want anybody pushed into the sea Palestinians who are being pushed into the sea now, or Jews. I think Jews should be allowed to live in historic Palestine as first-class citizens, but equal first-class citizens with all the other first-class citizens. Okay, let's move on to the another way the U.S. empire is trying to hold on here is by sanctioning Iran. That was a point made by Miles Honig on Press TV. I thought it was a good point. The U.S. thinks it can demonize Iran and rally Saudi Arabia and Israel against Iran, and somehow that's going to keep the U.S. relevant in the region. As I just said, I think the opposite is true. Iraq is also falling out of the imperial orbit. In our next slide, we see that Iraq is about to buy a large batch of Russian tanks. Now, I thought Iraq was occupied by the U.S. Well, it sort of is, but they're also becoming more independent because nobody in the region really wants to be yoked to the dying U.S. empire. And the dying U.S. empire won't even give the Iraqi government real weapons to fight ISIS with. Instead, the U.S. supports ISIS. So no wonder Iraq is now turning to the Russians.
Very interesting.
Okay, and how about North Korea? The U.S. empire collapsing in the Middle East, but elsewhere as well. In Korea this week, we had an article at the Australian newspaper, news.com.au, that the North Korean crisis continues and Trump can't force Kim to capitulate and on again. The U.S. empire doesn't run the Korean peninsula either, and the South Korean leadership, the newly elected leadership, doesn't want war with the North. They actually wouldn't mind moving towards reunification and kicking the U.S. out. So once again, the U.S. empire is on the way out, but Tony, they've got an ace in the hole here, and that is in the next slide we see a technological solution. They're going to create the battlefield of things. You've heard of the Internet of Things, where your vacuum cleaner will be connected to your refrigerator so it will know when it's time to vacuum up the refrigerator or something like that. Anyway, the U.S. military is going to link up all of its human-killing devices and turn them over to computer power to run them and command them, and that's going to save the U.S. empire. Boy, what could possibly go wrong?
Well, going back to Korea, just before we leave that, this article that we feature in our list of URLs, it on North Korea, it certainly changes the tone from the alarmist approaches that we've been reading about over recent weeks. It speaks about something called mutual deterrence and actually is lowering the rhetoric a lot and suggesting that actually the North Koreans can be dealt with, and they can be reasonable if you treat them in a considerate way.
If you tweet them in a considerate way, so listen to that, Trump. Tweet them in a considerate way.
Before going past this story here, the Internet of Battlefield Things, a very strange use of language on this site called Defense One. The way I'm reading this is that they're dealing with things that are kind of classified, and they're writing about things that are just sort of marginal to be made public, and it's sort of obscure the way they write about them. But as I understand it, it's saying it's basically artificial intelligence in the realm of weaponry, that there has to be more intelligence put, more software put in these drones and different kind of killing robots, so that they can make decisions on the spot. They don't have to be be directed and flown as if it's some kind of extension that you're looking in the screen and driving it that way. And there's all of these ways of scanning of sensors. And the U.S., I'm sure, has sensors in the sky, in the space, in the oceans, and having information coming from these sensors that these weapons can then ingest and calculate. Computate. This is what this article is about. When I think about these sensors, for instance, I would say that Fukushima, the U.S. military would know how much radioactivity is emerging from Fukushima. They would have sensors. They, after all, are preparing for nuclear battles of different sorts, and they have all kinds of nuclear weapons, and they have to anticipate, how to operate in radioactive zones. So this is a very sort of obscurely written article, but it speaks to major issues that should be politically discussed, not dealt in this, not dealt with in this esoteric way, like in this article.
Well, that's right. But the bottom line here, Tony, is that turning over the decision about how to use killing machines to artificial intelligence is really putting everybody at risk, frankly. Well, the empire may be collapsing everywhere else, but they're pushing back at Venezuela. In our next slide, we see my Press TV commentary suggesting that this woman shot dead image, this meme that was spread, supposedly blaming the Venezuelan government for the shooting of a woman standing in line at the fake poll. They were having like a fake election in Venezuela, the color revolution. The rich people in Venezuela were trying to take back the country, spent a ton of money creating a fake election that's not even a real election in Venezuela to try to propagandize for their cause. And then we had a woman shot dead, like Joe Cox before the Brexit vote, obviously propaganda. But my take on Venezuela, which basically I support Hugo Chavez and his heirs, but there's some question about whether his heirs are actually worthy heirs, and that they were expressed in this next article, being honest about Venezuela from the socialist worker. So Tony, who's right? You know, am I right to try to say that, you know, Maduro is probably, you got to support him against this color revolution? Or was this author right in saying that Maduro's people are so corrupt that nobody should be supporting anybody?
Well, in your little soundbite interview in Press TV, you simplified the matter. It was pretty much good guys and bad guys, and the noble Chavistas, Chavissimo, Hugo Chavez, and those who followed him, and the right-wing U.S.-supported dastardly people trying to topple that regime. This Socialist Worker article, however, has a different take on it. The Maduro regime has actually betrayed, it argues, some of the basic principles of the revolution, that there's a lot of corruption, that Maduro is trying to kind of go towards the middle and be and incorporate different interests, and that he's playing along with corruption. And that it's not a simple matter of good guys and bad guys, that there's lots of maltreatment of Venezuela coming from all sides right now. Hello?
So, sorry, I just had to fix there's rain coming through my skylight here. Here in western Wisconsin, we're having historic floods, the second 100-year flood. Since 2007. Anyway, not getting too wet. back to Venezuela. Yeah, that's where we were. Well, in our next slide, we see that this rogue Venezuelan cop, another false flag stunt, in my opinion, to push the color revolution meme, is on the run, but he's there at the opposition rallies. So it's really chaos there, Tony. And whoever you want to blame, whether it's corruption among Maduro's people or whether it's the New World Order pushback, I mean, the bottom line for me is I don't want these regime change operations to succeed anywhere. I think the first thing we need to do is to stop those.
Yeah, it's interesting that this argument that Oscar Perez, who is sort of an action figure in movies and seems to be a symbol of opposing the Maduro government and kind of popularizing it, portraying this opposition to Maduro as a kind of exciting, edgy thing in the media, that one theory is that Maduro himself or that regime does false flags or did a false flag. He is a kind of false flag used to energize defenders of the government in power against these interlopers from the right wing.
Okay, well, we have 10 minutes for, I think, 11 stories. So let's see if we can do it. Moving over to Saudi Arabia and Qatar, this is where I debated Frederick Peterson the first time this past week. And he wasn't too happy with what I had to say in this debate either. I already mentioned my take on this, which is that Qatar, Iran, and Turkey are the relatively progressive side of this. But maybe it's not really about ideology. Maybe it's really about, ta-da, natural gas. That's what our next slide suggests. And I think if you want to simplify what's at stake here, what's really driving this conflict, putting natural gas at the center of the analysis probably would be the right move.
And it seems that Qatar and Iran share a natural gas field of some sort, and that they want to work together to develop this and to develop the pipeline connection to Europe. And so definitely that is a part of what's going on here.
That's right. But another part of it, Tony, is that Israel is manipulating its partners or its slaves or whatever you want to call them. That would be the Trump administration, the Saudis, and so on, Egypt, and using them to try to crush Hamas. So there was this article that I think Alan sent this one in, pointing out that Hamas is under tremendous pressure due to this Saudi attack on Qatar. Qatar has been spending billions to try to rebuild Gaza, but Gaza still has no power most of the time. The water isn't safe. It's unlivable. And with Qatar pressured this way, the question is, you know, can Hamas survive? Can Gaza survive? What do you think, Tony?
Will Hamas become more friendly with Fatah, with Abbas, which they're not now? As I understand it, Hamas sided with the moderate rebels or such, in so-called moderate rebels, against the Assad regime, making it difficult for the relationship with Iran. So Hamas is getting quite isolated, and now that its ally Qatar is itself being isolated, it's getting increasingly narrow the space for Hamas and difficult, just as it seems that Israel may be building up to yet another cutting of the grass in Gaza. Obviously, this making life unlivable in that zone, they don't want people living there. They don't want people living, Palestinian people living in Gaza.
Well, that's called genocide. Well, Israel is trying to crush its opposition everywhere, not only in Palestine, but in the U.S. as well. As we move on to our Madness of Zion category, this story, Tony, really outraged me. Of all of the outrageous things that we saw this week, this is the one that had me, you know, ready to join a military action against the Zionist occupation of the United States of America. They're going to make it a felony to support boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So if we support BDS here on False Flag Weekly News, if we refuse to allow Israelis to give us money, then wait a minute. Why would we do that? If Israelis want to give us money, go right ahead, Israelis. Go to that fundraiser page and give us some money. We're not boycotting you, because if we did, we'd be charged with a felony and given this like $500,000, $1 million, however, fine, and locked up in prison for 20 years. So Israelis, we're not boycotting you. Go ahead. Give us all your money.
This story is one of those moments where you kind of pinch yourself and say, are we really living through this? Is this really happening in our own societies? Weren't we taught when we entered school and we took civics and such that we were liberal democracies and there was a right of protest and dissent, and in fact, this is how you made your country better, by trying to be responsible politically, even if it meant going against powerful authorities. And when you think about it, the idea that making a statement in the market, isn't it supposed to be our money? And when we go into the market, isn't our major freedom supposed to be we can spend it where we want, or not spend it where we want, or save it where we want, or invest it where we want, or not where we want, places that we like or places that we want to avoid. This is unbelievable that it's kind of happening in our midst. To criminalize this, to make it the subject of, you know, $250,000 fine or $1 million fine, 20 years in prison for answering your conscience, for trying to get over the hatred within our societies and say, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be part of that. I want to make life better, especially for the oppressed and marginalized people of the world. To make that into a crime, that is, you know, unthinkable, that this is happening in our midst, and yet it is.
They should have called this the mandatory support for genocide law. If you don't support genocide in Palestine, you're going to be locked up in prison for 20 years. That's the post 9/11 America after the Zionist coup d'etat, in which they murdered 3,000 Americans and essentially took over the country and used the U.S. military to kill 32 million people around the world and utterly destroy their neighborhood. Frankly, Tony, I am ready to join a military action against the Israeli occupation of the United States, and I'll do that as soon as there are enough people who are willing to join me. Moving on, AIPAC is still our biggest foreign agent, not the Russians. That's our next slide. That's a good reminder. We're heard, it's nothing but Russians and Trump. Well, what about AIPAC and Trump and AIPAC and everybody else? They completely own and dominate our government, as our previous story showed.
And I suppose that there are some in the United States who think of Israel as just part of the United States, and it doesn't seem in any way contradictory that it is actually a power that has a different sovereign construction than the United States, and that it is not, the United States is not supposed to be run in the interests of a foreign power. It's supposed to be run in the interests of America first. America first.
And how about Canada, Tony? B'nai B'rith Canada is overplaying its hand. We have like 4 minutes for several stories, so tell us briefly about this one.
Well, Nikki Ashton is running for head of the NDP party, which has a pretty good representation in parliament. It's the Social Democratic Party. And Tom Mulcair, the leader who's leaving, he was very pro-Israeli Zionist. Here is a candidate, Nikki Ashton, whose domain is Aboriginal Affairs. She's the Aboriginal Affairs critic running for head of the NDP. She is protective of Palestinian human rights. And she has been attacked by B'nai B'rith Canada, the folks that attack you, that attack me, and attack others, for taking this principled stance. And they tried to depict her as, you know, cozying up to terrorists, because of course you just say the word Palestinian, and from the point of view of B'nai B'rith Canada, apparently that's pretty much synonymous with a terrorist. This is reflects badly on Mostyn, the leader of B'nai B'rith, the CEO of B'nai B'rith, who of course quotes from Joshua Goldberg texts in my case and other cases. And, you know, apparently is not aware that Joshua Goldberg produces this hate speech in his the basement of his parents. That's the official story. I don't think it's the true story. But anyway, this reflects badly on B'nai B'rith Canada.
Well, it's pretty hard to not reflect badly on B'nai B'rith Canada unless you lie about them, because they're, you know, they're the mafia. And speaking of the mafia, the Canadian Khazarian mafia, which is rabidly anti-Semitic, is persecuting a real Semite, Jonathan Azazea. Jonathan is half Jewish, he's Iraqi, he's fully Semitic, and because he has views that are very much in line with the vast majority of Semites on Earth, he's being persecuted by the anti-Semites of Canada, the ADL, the B'nai B'rith, et cetera, so Jonathan, the police were after him for supposed hate speech because he's rapping against Israel. He did escape back into the U.S., so I heard. He slipped back across the border. They didn't get him. So shout out to Jonathan Azazea, the brave freedom-fighting rocker, the rapper.
I really don't like a lot of his prose. To me, it is just a little too visceral. But, you know, this is a question of whether one criticizes one. And, you know, you can criticize poetry, you can criticize artistic creation, but to criminalize it is itself a crime.
Well, yeah, I've had arguments with Jonathan before. He is a little hardcore in certain respects for my taste. And in fact, for a while, he stopped coming on my radio show because he thought I was, like, too friendly to Jews and Zionists and things like that. And I am perfectly friendly to Jews. And I'll even be friendly to Zionists. I'll just tell them that they're wrong. But he's, you know, he's telling the truth the way he sees it. And I like the fact that he's really out there and in your face. And so when they try to, you know, go after him criminally for his rap lyrics, which are basically pro-liberation, that's going too far. And speaking of persecuting people who criticize the Zionist power configuration's neo sacred mythology, how about Alison Chablos? I just heard about her this week through Lasha Darkman's article. She's a British singer-songwriter who posted a sort of a parody satirical piece on the Holocaust, or a satirical song, and all hell broke loose.
Yeah, she's a very intelligent songwriter. It's very penetrating. It's full of irony and parody and intelligence. Lash of Dark Moon makes the contrast. You know, what about the awful things that Sarah Silverstein talks about with respect to Christians and, you know, and Christ and, well, you know, that was a good thing that Christ got killed by the Jews. I do it myself, she says. Genji Cohen. The kind of double standards that some groups can just be whipped, verbally whipped, subjected to horrific language, but other groups have this you know, enormous protection that Michael Mostyn is one of those. That's the name I was seeking, Michael Mostyn's first name, Michael Mostyn, CEO of B'nai B'rith Canada. I mean, he seems to me he uses very aggressive hate type speech, and
well, what so is let's hate?
Yeah, well, yeah. It's you know, I guess it's ironic the way the people who are most prone to use this accusation of hate speech are so into it themselves.
And sometimes, you know, anger or rage, as we see in the next slide, is perfectly justified. In occupied Palestine, they're having a day of rage as the Israelis have basically taken over the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the greatest Islamic architectural monument and the oldest one, and have cut off the access to it. They've already massively restricted access, and the next thing you know, they're going to go ahead and demolish it and put up a blood sacrifice temple to be ruled by the Antichrist. I mean, that's basically their plan as far as we can tell. So rage. What's wrong with rage against injustice, Tony? Is that hate? No. Rage against injustice is good.
Well, the Al-Aqsa definitely seems to be targeted. You know, it was part of what happened in 1967 in the takeover of the territories that was meant to be part of the Arab state, the Palestinian state. And there is a very powerful, important constituency within Zionism, within Israel, wanting to build the third temple with the cheering support, for instance, of Latter-day Saints or Baha'i, you know, a whole Christian group sort of look to this building of the third temple as the fulfillment of prophecy and the coming back of Christ, the Messiah, and then the Jews will embrace the Messiah, and the end of the world will come, and we'll all be divided as we are in the rapture. Anyway, this is this move to little by little take control of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This has huge implications, and people are watching very closely. In this case, it has to do with putting metal detectors. Israeli government putting metal detectors against Muslim people going to do their devotion in their own mosque, in their own sacred place, the third most sacred place,
you know,
in Islam.
A day of rage against that is perfectly appropriate. And likewise, we need to have some rage against the civil forfeiture laws here in the United States. You're innocent until proven guilty, and yet they can steal your money without even charging you with anything. If the cops want your money, they can just take it, and they can make up any story they want, and there's no due process. And now Jeff Sessions wants to make it easier for cops to do that. And we learned in the next slide that U.S. cops stole more in 2014 through their forfeiture, their unconstitutional forfeitures, than criminals stole through burglary. So the worst criminals in the U.S. are the cops. And we see them shooting people down left and right. We didn't talk about the story in Minneapolis where they murdered an Australian natural health doctor. But this happens constantly. You know, would it be hate speech to say I hate this injustice of cops being the worst murderers and robbers in the United States?
And how do we talk about something called organized crime in this milieu, in this environment?
They are organized crime, as Frank Serpico learned. Well, we're at the end of the show, Tony, and for our final story, in the Can't Make This Stuff Up department, we have an Israeli art student busted stealing objects from Auschwitz. Israeli art students were implicated in 9/11, of course. Gelatin was the Israeli art team that helped blow up the Twin Towers, and Israeli art students were swarming all over the alleged hijackers, controlling them, hundreds of them living next door to Mohammed Atta. biggest bust of foreign spies in U.S. history was the Israeli spies who were involved in orchestrating 9/11. And that all went public, was reported on Fox News by Carl Cameron, and then suppressed by the Zionist power configuration. Well, here we have the Israeli art students now stealing from Auschwitz. But of course, that's okay, because she's afraid that if I don't steal these objects and preserve them, the Holocaust will just become a myth.
Well, there is a artistic dimension to finding words these days to somehow differentiate fact from fiction.
So you can't make it up, Tony. Have to report it. I mean, we're just going to tell you the truth about what's happening in the world. And it's way beyond the craziest black comedy by Ionesco. So come back next week, and Comedy Kevin will try to find something darkly amusing for the end of next week's False Flag Weekly News. Thank you so much, Tony.
Kevin's Comedy viewers. Hour.
Kevin's Comedy Hour. All right. Okay. So thank you all for paying attention. See you next week. God willing. Sure, yeah.